This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. New businesses, a big vacancy about to be sold, and now new recycling bins. Downtown Bloomington is having a bit of a moment.
We've been seeing more and more business owners come to the Economic Development Department and are interested in downtown.
Hear from Bloomington Economic Development Director Melissa Hahn and others on positive signs downtown. And Mike and Murph hammer out the best way to build a treehouse on Grow. And John Norton gets to preview the first full-length album from the local act Disorganizer ahead of the Friday night show. That after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. For several years now, downtown Bloomington has played second fiddle to Uptown Normal. But after a tough 2018, this year has taken a positive turn for Bloomington's Central Business District. This story begins with Janet Mariani, who needed a home for her first business, an ice cream shop. She chose downtown Bloomington. She considered Uptown Normal instead, but it already has an ice cream shop. And Mariani had fallen in love with downtown over the past 3 years as she painted it Merlot in a masterpiece. She also knew downtown needed something for kids. Breaking news, kids love ice cream.
It's just a different vibe. You get a more homey feeling down here.
Mariani's Main Street Scoop opened May 25th. It's one of many pieces of good news this year in downtown Bloomington. That includes many other new business openings and one notable business that's staying put, plus the pending sale of the State Farm Building, the creation of the city's new Economic Development Department, and the formal designation of the Cultural District. Downtown even has its first recycling bins this summer. In short, downtown Bloomington is having a bit of a moment.
It's changed a lot since I've been here. I've seen the changes, so it's coming back, I think. It's coming back strong.
For several years, downtown has been overshadowed by Uptown Normal, where the town of Normal has invested heavily in new construction and cultural programming. That's according to Greg Yant, manager of Caldwell Banker Commercial Real Estate in Bloomington. As Uptown Normal worked to lure daytime workers with the Trail East project, downtown's 2018 began with news State Farm was vacating its building there. Yant says now it's the more recent positive developments, including the city's new four-person economic development department, that are being noticed.
Very loyal customers and business owners and real estate owners who are very loyal to the downtown.
One of them is Specs Around Town. Julie Kupsch, owner of the boutique eyewear retailer, actually announced in 2018 that she was leaving downtown too. She planned to be part of Vision Point, a new $10 million eye center opening August 6th on Bloomington's east side. But 2 weeks ago, Kupsch announced she was staying independent and staying put in downtown, a decision mutually reached with Vision Point. She'll close for 2 to 3 weeks in July for some remodeling at 317 North Center Street, then reopen August 1st. Kupsch says she loves her familiar location and her space.
It's just a really awesome community of people, and they get it. They get the shopping local, the other business owners. It's a very nice community of getting to know the other business owners, and everybody can relate to how hard one works when they have their own business.
Specs Around Town has been downtown for 20 years. Kupsch has seen the ebb and flow. For example, Main Street Scoop opens for business, but then Bedtime Boutique owner Brenda Tannehill announced Tuesday she's retiring, will close August 31st.
I think I've learned, over 2 decades that change is slow, and it's always a little, yay, there's 3 great things, and then 2 not so good things happen. And then 1 great thing happens and 3 bad things happen.
Daniela Barracaro felt that excitement in March when she opened her downtown business, a little art school at 415 North Main. She offers classes and programs to artists of all ages with a focus on especially young children and families. Barracaro teaches at Illinois State University's School of Art.
Being ISU faculty, I've been an Uptown Normal kind of girl for a long time.
But she says she was attracted to downtown in part by her new landlord, Mike Manna's plans to create space for creative businesses.
And this was really the first place that I felt like I had a connection with, and I really, really wanted it to work because I just loved it. I loved the feel and the energy of the place and the people, and also just the welcoming vibe that I got from owners of businesses and from Mike and from the other people who are starting their own businesses too.
Another new downtown business is Tony's Tacos, which opened a second location in July 2018 at 105 West Front Street, across from the McLean County Law and Justice Center. The first Tony's Tacos opened at Normal near ISU in 2016. Co-owner Norma Ortiz says they liked the downtown location because it had a seating area and a bar so they could finally deliver the margaritas customers have been clamoring for. And she says downtown didn't really have a sit-down Mexican restaurant before.
So we tried it. And, you know, I think we're doing pretty good. You know, of course, you know how everything is. We're new, so a lot of people don't even know that we're there. And many people that do go in there, they're like, oh, my God, you have a bar. It's totally different than the other Tony's.
She says the biggest challenge has been parking and construction. Front Street, right in front of Tony's, was torn up for most of the spring for extensive road work.
Customers, you know, we run into them like, oh, we were going downtown. There's no parking. There was no parking. So we had to leave. And I'm like, oh, I feel so bad because there was no parking because of all the construction. But now that they fixed up the roads, it looks really nice. It gives it a whole new look and atmosphere to downtown.
Coldwell Banker commercial broker Laura Pritz just sold 413 North Center Street, a two-story building with two upstairs apartments and a first-floor business space. Pritz says there was a lot of interest from retailers and service businesses looking to occupy the first floor and rent out the second for some extra income.
I was pleasantly surprised at the amount of activity that we received on that.
Pritz says storefronts are in demand downtown. She says demand for office space is soft. That's true community-wide. Greg Yant, also with Coldwell Banker, agrees.
You know, I wouldn't say, you know, that everybody's jumping out of their shoes, but I think there's a good, modest level of activity.
The city of Bloomington is working to maintain and share online a more comprehensive list of commercial vacancies for lease or purchase in the downtown area. That's according to Melissa Hahn, director of the city's three-month-old Economic Development Department. The city's downtown division was folded into that new department, and Hahn says that's already leading to valuable streamlining on communications, leading to better coordination of social media announcements and creation of new downtown-specific notifications through the city's GovDelivery marketing tool.
Definitely, you know, the buzz about downtown, we've been seeing more and more business owners come to the Economic Development Department and are interested in downtown.
One of the most visible vacancies downtown may soon be filled, at least partially. State Farm is set to close this summer on the sale of its former downtown headquarters, which it vacated last year. State Farm used to have hundreds of workers based there, and a former alderman described State Farm's exit as a wake-up call for the city's downtown revitalization efforts. The buyer and purchase price have not been disclosed. Champaign-based broker Jill Guth, who's handling the deal, says the new owner wants to find a restaurant tenant for the first floor with office and some co-working space above that. The mystery buyer had a 90-day window to perform due diligence on the property while also actively searching for tenants. Here's Greg Yant with Coldwell Banker.
It's going to be very important that he has some very serious people willing to commit, you know, medium or long term there before they're going to buy it. We would like nothing more than to see that happen, but there's really no certainty to that. We just want to be, we're very careful with when we talk to people who ask about it, just say, you know, it's not a deal yet.
State Farm spokesperson Gina Morse-Fisher says nothing new to report. We continue to work through the process. There is a lot of unfinished business downtown. Recommendations in the Downtown Bloomington Task Force's final report, issued in October 2017, are still largely unaddressed. Bloomington Planning Commission Chair Justin Boyd, who served on that task force, said the recent resurfacing of Main Street was a good opportunity to enact at least one of those recommendations, removing a lane of traffic to make it safer for pedestrians and create more parking spots. The task force's call for a so-called catalyst project also received a muted response from the Bloomington City Council. A proposed joint Connect Transit Library catalyst project failed to gain traction, and now Connect Transit is moving ahead on its own with plans to build a new transfer center downtown. And highly visible eyesores like the front and center building remain vacant. Mayor Terry Renner has expressed interest in using eminent domain to seize the building across from Grossinger Motors Arena, but that's yet to happen. Still, for now, there is momentum. Last month, the Bloomington City Council formally established the city's 20-block downtown cultural district and set its geographic boundaries. That could open the door for more grant funding, according to Melissa Hahn with the city.
Keep your
eyes peeled. There's things in the works all the time, so we're looking forward to some fall openings of some new and exciting things downtown.
One of the biggest weekends of the summer is just a few days away in downtown. GLT's summer concert is Saturday, June 8th. All weekend long, the Cogs and Corsets Steampunk Happening Festival will also be taking place. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
Support for GLT comes from the Economic Development Council presenting BN by the Numbers Thursday, June 27th at ISU's Alumni Center. It's an update on local economic progress in McLean County. Tickets are available by emailing Becky at bnbiz.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. During this year's record-breaking flood, the Mississippi River Cities and Towns Initiative is promoting solutions to deal with the increased frequency and severity of floods, plus the damage they cause. IPR's Michelle O'Neill reports one possibility is for Congress to create a revolving loan fund for identifying, restoring, and creating wetlands within the Mississippi River Basin.
Every time we have a flood, and we've had plenty of them since 93, we drain the revenue that we have, and yes, we do get reimbursed some portions from FEMA, but it just keeps lowering and lowering and lowering our ability to survive.
And we're starting to have conversations about the Mississippi River as an entire river or corridor, because what happens up in Iowa tremendously impacts us. Like Mayor Gallagher said, it's coming our way. So I hope we start to continue discussions about the Mississippi River as an entire system and not just Alton's portion of the Mississippi or Mayor Smiley's portion of the Mississippi, because it impacts everybody from Iowa all the way down to Louisiana.
We don't want to create more problems downriver as well. An ongoing flood wall that literally pushes everything further downstream. We know a couple of communities south of us that literally would be washed away.
We know what to do, and we have the plan ready to go. And if we don't somehow get to Congress and make them aware to the point that they support what we have proposed in the establishment of the Resilience Revolving Loan Fund and increasing the pre-disaster mitigation grant for us all, if we don't get this done, we're not going to be able to successfully accomplish our goals.
Those are the voices of Mayor Phil Stang from Kimswick, Missouri, Alton, Illinois Mayor Brant Walker, Davenport, Iowa Mayor Frank Klipsch, and Clarksville, Missouri Mayor Joanne Smiley. The members of the Mississippi River Cities and Towns Initiative are calling on Congress to take action on their proposals to help prepare for and respond to repeated floods. Bettendorf, Iowa Mayor Bob Gallagher says one proposal is the creation of a federal resilience revolving loan fund.
If we could reduce the amount of water going downstream at the speed at which it is now traveling through wetlands restoration and maybe creation of newer wetlands, and then a lock and dam system that takes that into consideration, we can win up and down the river as one ecology. And that's the mission of the MRCTI.
The mayor's initiative has already had success persuading Congress to adopt some of its policies.
We have moved the allocation for certain projects, including those from the Corps, from $22 million to $146 million a year. We are making progress. Another avenue is to remember that this is an interstate system. We got it named as such as a result of the efforts of the MRCTI. So it can fall into the transportation infrastructure project. That's another source of income. So this is an opportunity to have M35, Marine Highway 35, access funds in an infrastructure bill because of the barge traffic.
Gallagher says a revolving loan fund would allow states and cities to do flood mitigation projects, then repay the federal loan with savings from the improvements. The Mississippi River mayors want $100 million for the fund to start with.
We have to start to walk before we can run. It has to first be seen by the federal government as an entity and not placed in the hands of the local folks who have to deal with their own cities and the states who encapsulate smaller portions of the 11-state region up and down the Mississippi. We need to look at the Mississippi as one living, breathing, working river so that what they're doing in Minnesota doesn't adversely affect us in Iowa and us adversely affect Illinois, Missouri.
Currently, Mississippi River cities and towns are dealing with the third major crest of the year, and several levees and temporary flood walls have failed. Alton, Illinois Mayor Brant Walker is worried about short attention spans.
It kind of makes the news, but after the floods go away, I have a tendency to see the conversations go away, And I hope we continue to have these discussions, not only probably the rest of this summer, but when we get through the fall and then the next year, about how we start to manage the Mississippi River as a total corridor.
One thing won't go away: snow melt and spring rain. I'm Michelle O'Neill.
The Illinois River at Peoria is expected to drop below 26 feet today. It's the second highest crest ever and well above the 19-foot flood stage. This is Sound Ideas. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. A small rural town in northern Illinois voted to deactivate its high school in the fall. Now the final year is just about over. So what is it like to be in the last graduating class, and how has the community reacted? IPR's Peter Medlin has more.
The final seconds tick off the clock and the school day is over. One of the last of the school year at Pawpaw. Buses are lined up outside waiting for students as they trickle out. The halls are a little more empty now. The senior class has already graduated. It's a small taste of what the school will look like next year, when there are no high schoolers left at all. Pawpaw voters decided to deactivate their high school last November. They'll still have kindergarten through 8th grade, but the high schoolers will now be bused to nearby Indian Creek High School. Pawpaw has been facing the same funding and enrollment struggles plaguing rural schools across the state. Their total K-12 enrollment dropped by more than 30 students in the last 5 years. Their district currently sits just under 200 students. In the meantime, Indian Creek will be adding more than 50 students with the new Pawpaw kids. The deactivation vote narrowly passed, and only one Pawpaw high schooler was old enough to vote in the election.
And I voted to actually keep the school here.
His name is Anthony Castaldo. He's a member of that final graduating class.
It is weird. You have these bunch of other people who get to, like, the alumni of their schools get to go back to their school, like, visit it. And I don't really get to do that, but that's okay.
Even though he knew there were supporters of the deactivation, he was still surprised to see it passed.
I remember there was a bunch of Facebook arguments about that, but I thought that was just an overreaction from a small group of people. I didn't realize how many people were willing to just deactivate the school.
Students at the schools are already very familiar with each other. They had homecoming together this year, and Pawpaw students had already been going to Indian Creek for some sports and classes. Kendall Hallbaker is a 16-year-old finishing her sophomore year at Pawpaw.
Yeah, I take Spanish 1 and World Geography over there.
One of the perks of the new students coming over is that Indian Creek will expand class offerings. That includes an upper-level Spanish 4 course.
I've lived in Pawpaw my whole entire life, and my dad and his brother and my grandma also graduated from Pawpaw.
Her family eventually supported the deactivation, but the decision wasn't easy.
They were kind of surprised and sad too, because like Pawpaw has been here forever and like we're the only like small town that like has really lasted for so long.
Along with the students, only one Pawpaw High School teacher will be moving over to Indian Creek. Pawpaw Superintendent Stan Adcock says he hopes the district can keep on those other teachers in any way they can. Castaldo said some of his teachers were upset by the vote.
I know a bunch of my teachers didn't expect it, so a bunch of my teachers I know just took it kind of like harshly, especially the ones who've been here for quite a while.
The end of the school year has been especially bittersweet for Patty Torman. She's been an administrator at Pawpaw for 27 years, and she's retiring. The news is still reaching some of the students.
You're retiring? Yes, I'm going to retire.
No!
Oh. I remember when you started.
Well, it was nice meeting you for
nice
the
meeting
month
you.
I've been here.
Yeah. I'll see ya.
Yeah.
She said she'll still be around. She lives close and has a granddaughter in elementary school at Pawpaw. The school is still figuring out what exactly to do with the empty space without the high school. But despite the deactivation, Pawpaw will continue to offer kindergarten through 8th grade classes. I'm Peter Medlin.
This is Sound Ideas. Just ahead after a break, get introduced to another one of our GLT summer concert performers.
Support for WGLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, celebrating extraordinary local residents who give back to our community. Submit your nomination for the Philanthropists of the Year Award through July 31st. Nomination forms available at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
Generations of children have watched eagerly as dads and moms have built tree houses. Not all parents have made good choices, though, in constructing these pint-sized perches or even choosing the right tree to use. Patrick Murphy and GLT's Mike McCurdy hammer together the best practices on tree houses in this edition of GLT's Grow.
It used to be a couple of 12-year-old kids, scrap wood, and tools borrowed from dad could get a tree house in a tree. But doing it right and safely involves much more. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice. From our expert, Patrick Murphy, from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. Hey, Murph, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So with tree houses, I guess the same rule applies that applies to any real estate. Location, location, location?
You are correct, sir. I think that location is important on several fronts for the tree houses. So location would help you determine what's the best tree. That tree should be one that's in good health. And generally speaking, you can kind of split your decision making into two criteria: soft, flexible trees, which are fast growing, are bad candidates for anything built in a tree, a tree stand, anything. So a slow growing hard tree, oak is a good one to think about. And is it in a location that, is it too close to the house so the squirrels are going to be able to go, into your treehouse freely? You also have to think about what's the worst thing that can happen. What if your treehouse brought the tree down? Is it close enough to the house that Or caught fire.
Because kids sometimes play with matches, right?
Or if somebody fell out of it. Huh. Is it on a edge of a bluff? Is it over your barbed wire collection? you got to think about all these.
Sure.
These seem ridiculous, but it makes a lot of sense to avoid disaster by starting out with a good selection.
What goes into a good plan or design for a treehouse?
I think you need to consider how you're going to use it. So a lot of other treehouse builders have kind of come up with your interior. Is it going to be covered? Are you going to have a deck or a porch? You got to be able to get in and out of it. So there's going to be a ladder or some kind of elevator system. Elevator systems can also be used to build it and to get stuff rather than people up and down to the treehouse.
By elevators, you're talking like pulleys or like a dumbwaiter kind of situation?
Yeah, whatever the – if you got the pressurized air one, if you're the really high-end treehouser, or you got the one made out of bicycles, or you pedal it, and it kind of elevates. I thought that was a really creative thing I've seen. And you want the design considerations, like anything else in your landscape, to fit. It has to be relevant, If you had a dark gray house, it might be a good idea to paint the treehouse the same color. Stuff like that. Related materials, matching roof, matching this and that.
Does a treehouse actually have to be in a tree? Could it be tree adjacent, even have the trunk integrated, but not really attached? The structure's not really attached to the tree. The tree's sort of just growing through it.
I would bet that there are just as many treehouses that are not attached to the tree. They're just kind of close to it, right? And I think that that makes a lot of sense. So we can mount a treehouse in or under a tree, with the tree being either a visual anchor to the structure or being a host to hold the structure. Many tree houses are actually mounted on stilts but are placed near or under the branches of a tree for the effect. That's safest for the house and the users, and it's gentlest to the tree. And then you get your anchored platform construction. That's the basic tree house starting point that I think of in my imagination. That's where this deck or some kind of platform is implemented into a tree with decking for a floor, and the decking over the framework for the floor adds to structural integrity. And you can even do a single pair or three trees together that nestle or frame some kind of tree-oriented structure.
You said, trying to be gentle to the tree. What does it do to drive these anchors into a large branch or the trunk? Does that hurt the tree?
It sure can. A lot of times stuff that's lost in a tree, it becomes embedded there like a nail from a birdhouse or whatever. If it's a galvanized nail versus a steel or iron nail, there's not a lot of iron nails around anymore, but the galvanized nail will kind of last forever. The others can break down and rot and decompose inside the tree, and then you get a void inside the tree. That's not good. That could lead to other structural defects and be a entrance for other diseases and pests.
What about checking with your municipality? Could a construction permit, for instance, be necessary for a treehouse?
I think if you live in somewhere where you're paying premium property tax dollars, you might want to check and save yourself some headache. There are lots of times or ordinances related to where you can place a treehouse, that would be public versus private view. So they're going to ask you to keep it in the backyard, for example. And other places, too, it's a liability issue. Densely populated areas, the electrical conductors are closer to the ground in a lot of cases. So the tree houses have a height limit in many cases. And that leads to where the tree houses are, look like they're in the tree, but they're not, which we've talked about.
How does someone get started then?
You can create a sketch with your ideas to kind of get the early beginnings of a plan. Create your ideas, including the features, your building materials. At least this way you can kind of track your expenses and consider some of your options. And also you make a plan so that you're installing your tree house in the right order.
I would guess that there are plans online or in books that could be adapted for, you could just find the blueprints, you know, already sort of ready to go that has the list of materials and all of that. It could be pretty much laid out for you. You'd have to customize it on some level because there isn't such a thing as a standard tree.
I think it's a great idea to use a plan that somebody else has made, and you could still add your own preferences and tastes to it with the refinements that might be there. But I think that that's a great idea because it's likely that someone's tried that treehouse before and have worked out some of the issues.
If the plan says, you know, a 6-foot span here, you may only have a 4-foot span in your tree. So you'll have to be able to adapt it.
And that's another great reason to have the plan, because if that's going to shrink, there's going to be other things that are going to need adjusted, and the plan's going to serve you that way.
Should we talk about safety as it concerns using this tree or how it's built?
I think you should. So we can always utilize sturdy, well-constructed tie-downs. The joints and tree contact points work the best. And nowadays, we have the privilege of a hardware that's made specifically for mounting structures in or next to trees. There's a lot of it out there, and you'd be surprised at how many things that have been thought of.
So this is for it's healthy for the tree and sturdy enough to support the structure.
Yes, Mike,
kept
exactly.
Both of those in mind. Okay.
Exactly.
And what about safety-conscious construction?
Safety-conscious construction would have all of us wearing proper PPE and recognizing proper work practices, because there's going to be ladders and scaffolds. If you're lucky, there's a lift. If it's a real challenge, someone might have to climb. All of these things possess aerial hazards.
And what's PPE?
Personal protective equipment.
So make sure you have
hard hat, gloves, glasses.
For using chainsaw, chaps, all that, right?
Because you
may have to go into the tree and trim some stuff out of it, sort of prune the interior of the tree to make the treehouse fit, right?
Highly likely, I would think, yeah.
These treehouses, I did some poking around online, can be pretty fancy, and they can also even, I mean, some of them have had some very modern designs that would go with a mid-century modern home. But what about some higher-end accessories?
I noticed that there's some really cool stuff out there. I think that they're very interesting, too, because I like campers and treehouses alike, I guess. They have these cool little things like dumbwaiters. It would be a hand-over-hand rope that you could bring your water and your music and stuff up to the treehouse, for example. I've seen low voltage or direct current, and the low voltage ones that I've seen have a solar panel that's mounted on the ground, because you can't have solar in the shade. Treehouse is in the right spot, you might be able to put it right on the roof.
Think about how much lighting you could have with LED.
I know. And then they've got the trap door, of course, seems like a lot of fun for a kid's treehouse. Rope ladder, I'm not sure I'm in the shape to use a rope ladder anymore, but that'd be great for kids. Plus all the other refinements. You know, you can get the little coffee bar up there and
plug my Keurig in and have coffee in my treehouse.
Hey, honey, give me the Easy Bake Oven up here. Stat!
If you have any questions about gardening, such as building treehouses, let us know, and we might answer it on an upcoming episode of Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
You can find other episodes of Grow at wglt.org. The Bloomington Normal instrumental powerhouse Disorganizer unveils its first full-length album Friday night when the quartet performs at Night Shop in downtown Bloomington. Band members Travis Thacker and Ryan Nolan stop by the GLT studios to talk with John Norton about Dispara, which Nolan says is the Spanish word for to shoot.
It's actually kind of a riff on one of our other tunes called It Shoots, It Hits, which I think Stefan's kind of mentioned previously on the show.
Stefan is Stefan Robinson, another member of the band.
Yeah, Stefan Robinson, our mandolin player. So it's about the act of holding an arrow and a bow and not actually doing the act of shooting the bow, but you just release the arrow and it shoots, it hits.
Shoot, It Hits. It's from the new album, Dispara, from Disorganizer. You guys have really upped your game over the last, maybe what, 3-4 years since this band really came into existence. What happened?
The way that the band actually started was just Stefan and myself.
Travis now, by the way.
We were friends in college. We had shared some music business courses and kind of knew each other from other bands that we had played in. And so Stefan came in. My dad and I have a music store, Carl's Pro Band, here in town. And so Stefan would come in and kind of just hang out and talk once in a while. And he kept saying, you know, we should get together and play some. And I was just so busy that I never followed up on it. And we got together and it was just Stefan and I. He was actually playing drums at the time and I was playing saxophone. And so we got together and just jammed for a couple weekends maybe. And we really liked where it was heading. And I was like, you know, I think we should maybe take this to the next level and make it a full orchestration, you know. And so Ryan and then our drummer, Michael Carlson, and I had both played in various groups over the years. And I knew that they would be kind of a good fit for the vision that maybe Stefan and I had for the group. And so they came and joined us one day. And so we had two drummers, bass and saxophone. And we realized that two drummers was probably too much for the group that we had. And Stefan said, you know, I play mandolin too. So he pulled that out and played a little. And we're like, why was that not the beginning point?
I talked to Stefan 2 years ago talking about Disorganizer. He said he used the word jazz in air quotes.
Yes.
To describe the band. Do you still kind of do that, or is that just his thing? And are you a jazz band? If not, what are you?
I've been struggling.
Or does it matter?
I've been struggling with that a lot, and I've been thinking about that a lot recently. Just when you listen to a lot of the new music that's coming out, a lot of the new groups that are really able to split genre so effortlessly, it's more of a marketing thing in my opinion, and right now it's kind of a reestablishment of what our goals are as a band. And I don't feel like we are on the outside when we talk about ourselves as a jazz band. I don't think we're on the inside either, so there are a lot of opportunities to kind of split that genre and do whatever we want and just kind of call ourselves an instrumental band, and depending on the marketing that we're trying to take or what venue we're trying to play, kind of fit into that.
Got it. That's Ryan Nolan, Travis Thacker, also in studio from Disorganizer on GLT Sound Ideas. I want to get to that, your goals here in a little bit, but before that, let's play another song. It's called Manometric. Am I saying that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. What's Manometric?
So Manometric is another song title. We have some trouble coming up with good song titles. So that was actually on an old physics diagram poster that I have from the 1950s in my basement talking about sound waves. And I'm not exactly sure if I remember what manometric means, but it's a description of some aspect of the sound spectrum.
I love this sound, especially when it gets to the jamming part.
This is actually one of the earlier tunes that we wrote, and we were actually not even sure if we were going to put it on the album, we did get a couple really good recordings of it, and then one day we just decided, hey, we're going to try it again, and then it ended up being one of the best recordings that we've had and ended up sounding really good, so we decided to use it.
Travis, how do you guys come up with compositions? Is it a collaborative process, or does one person bring an idea to the group and you work off of that? Or
A little bit of both. I would say it kind of depends on the tune itself, but most of it is a pretty collaborative effort, which is, I think, the thing that draws all of us to the group, is that a lot of other groups that maybe any of us have really played in, you show up and you play the person's tune, and that's kind of how it goes. Whereas our group, there are some tunes that we have that were maybe somewhat fleshed out before they got there and had different parts together, but then we'll play through it a few times, and after that, everybody kind of adds their two cents and kind of helps, you know, form the tune into what it becomes. And I think kind of the cool thing with this group is kind of just the general fluid dynamic that we have as a group that allows us to form a tune, and then we'll play it for 6 months, and after that we might say, you know, I don't really like how that goes, so let's change it. And that's kind of the whole mentality of the group, is just being open to new ideas and not really locking ourselves into, like we spoke about before, into specific genres or specific styles, or even on a tune-to-tune basis, things change a lot, which is, I think, what we really dig about the group, you know?
When you guys perform ahead of time, how much are you rehearsing? I mean, how often are you rehearsing? How long are you rehearsing? Because it would seem that there's a lot that goes in. There's a lot going on in these songs.
So I've recently been focusing on getting my recording set up at my house. We usually rehearse once a week for a couple hours, and then we try to get some recordings in, just kind of how we're feeling. I think in the future, we're just going to try to, you know, push record on everything that we're doing during rehearsal, and then kind of start sifting through that and really just see if we can get really creative with some of the stuff we're coming up with. So
we want to rehearse tunes so that the, you know, the head and the different portions of the tune are tight, but we don't want to rehearse it to death to the point
strangling
where when we get to play the tune that it sounds rehearsed, or that it sounds contrived, really. So we want the tune to sound cohesive and tight, but we also want to allow for expansion in the tune. So I think that's something that we really focus on, even in rehearsal, is the freeness of playing together and letting the tune kind of take itself where it goes, as corny as that might sound. That's kind of like our mentality when we're playing tunes. So we want it to sound tight at the performance, but overall, like, I think our big goals in rehearsal are getting to the point where we can record certain tunes, and then also just being prepared with the set list and, you know, the individual portions of each tune. So
all right, I want to get to another song from Despara, and there's so many good ones. There's Sweet Tooth, there's Cold Line. I love Cold Line. There's, well, there's Todasco.
You mentioned Sweet Tooth,
yeah.
So it's kind of been a running joke for a while now that if any of our songs were to get picked up to be a sitcom theme song, that's the one. I feel like it's got this nice kind of catchy thing at the beginning. It's got a little bit of space in there, you know, for the credits and whatever else is rolling at the beginning. You kind of thematically add some visuals that would, you know, accommodate it.
It's got that nice jovial feel.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's just there's something coming. You can feel
it.
It
feels robust.
The song most likely to become a sitcom from the new Disorganizer album called Despara. This is Sweet Tooth, GLT Sound Ideas, with Travis Thacker and Ryan Nolan with the band. Ryan, you mentioned a little while ago about goals, and I don't know if Travis, you want to take this, or Ryan, you want to take this. You guys are a local band. Y'all have full-time jobs. You're all busy, but you do things like you've recorded videos for Knapp House Studios, right? First of all, what kind of goals do you guys have as a band? Do you want to get bigger and get away from your full-time jobs, or is it...
That's a weird spot that I think a lot of bands kind of find themselves in when you're not a professional musician that's gigging and making your primary source of income from music. But we've kind of been reestablishing our goals as we go and just kind of figuring out what works for us. Recently, you know, with places opening like Jazz Up Front and Night Shop, it's a lot easier to get our music and play and be successful playing out. But a lot of our goals are predominantly based on making Travis's job easier, because he was doing a lot of the active booking, a lot of the reaching out and trying to get people to hear our music and stuff. So having nicely packaged videos and solid recordings and stuff like that, my goal personally was to make his job a little bit easier so we could have a nice, you know, package that we could present.
Well, let me go to you, Travis, on that, since you are doing a lot of that business side. Do you need, even as a, I'll call it in air quotes, like Stefan would say, you know, your local band, you're not certainly not touring nationally.
No.
Even a band like you guys, do you need a video in these days?
I would say that it really helps marketing-wise. In our opinion, like the way that the videos came out and the album came out, it's really just a personification of what we're trying to do with our music. And I think it's all really fitting together, you know?
It's Travis Thacker, Ryan Nolan with Disorganizer, brand new album Dispara. This is fantastic. Top to bottom, the songs, the engineering and mixing and all that, what Ryan did, and the look of the album itself, the artwork. This is fantastic, top to bottom. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
I also wanted to throw in there that Nathan Parks did the artwork and artwork for this album, and
amazing.
It turned out just fantastic. We're super, super happy with it.
Travis Thacker and Ryan Nolan of Bloomington's Disorganizer spoke with GLT's John Norton. Disorganizer performs Friday night at Night Shop in downtown Bloomington when they unveil their new album, Dispara. Discover other local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. This is Sound Ideas. The Something Brothers guitarist Edwin Pierce says it was surprisingly easy for band members to create and record new music together, despite a nearly 30-year studio hiatus and missing a key band member. A reunion performance by the legendary Bloomington Normal Outfit in 2017 morphed into the group's first full album since the early 1990s. The 10-song Apollo was released last year. In this encore broadcast ahead of their appearance at the GLT Summer Concert on Saturday, Pierce and vocalist-lyricist Scott Wilson reviewed the album with GLT's John Norton. Pierce likened writing and recording with bandmates after all those years to getting back on a bicycle.
Yeah, I mean, it comes naturally to us. I mean, honestly, it really, if we got one gift, is we're able to, you just see it. You just hear it and you go, that's it. And I don't know why, but there's some kind of an intuitive thing that we have.
It was pretty spooky, actually, like when we first got into the practice rehearsal space and started flushing out these songs. It just was so weird how it just felt like it hadn't been 30 years. It seemed like we were just in the studio together 5 months ago.
So, yeah, for instance, a lot of my things, because I've been playing bass guitar a lot, came in as bass demos. Tommy's didn't come in as electric guitar stuff. It came as an acoustic. I'd listen to his thing as an acoustic, and I'm going, I'm not so quite seeing the vision quite yet. And then Scott would go put the lyric to it, and then we'd get the electric guitars on, and all of a sudden it went from a nice kind of acoustic song to one hell of a rock song. So,
well, can you give me an example of one song? Can you think of one
Yucca
song?
Yucca Flat was
Yucca
one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like an acoustic.
Yeah, the riff was on acoustic. Everything was on acoustic. And then when it came out to actually flushing it out, it turned out to be a rip-roaring, you know, rock your head off song, which I was shocked, actually. But I was really happy. Set me up.
Yucca Flat is from the new album Apollo by the Something Brothers, their first album in nearly 30 years. Well, let's talk about the concept itself. The name of the album is Apollo, and there are numerous references to space, looking down from space, spaceships, right? Earthbound is another one. I mean, there's just all these...
It was weird that way. It's pretty accidental, to tell you.
It was. And let's play the movie part of Fuzzle, which opens up...
That's the one I was going to make.
Yeah,
Ed had written this demo. His working title was Fuzzle. I always like to use someone's working title as potential lyric jumping off points. And I was asking him what Fuzzle meant. He goes, I have no idea. I was thinking it was just a silly made up word. And I was thinking about how children make silly made-up words. And all of a sudden, I started thinking about old toys, and my favorite toy of all time was the G.I. Joe space capsule, the Gemini space capsule, you know, that I got for Christmas in 1966 and just went crazy over the thing. And I thought, I'm going to write a song about this space capsule toy, and then it just naturally turned into referencing other toys in it. We're still spinning like a top. We're headed straight for the center of the zone. The edge sketches up in the red. And so it's kind of like a song about a kid's version of what it might be like to be in space. He's, you know, he's referencing the
Etch-a-sketch.
The Etch-a-sketch and a spirograph and a kaleidoscope and all these things, because he couldn't think of what to call this thing in the capsule that made the retro rockets fire. He goes, oh, I'll just call it an Etch-a-sketch. And so it's kind of just about this kid, a child in space. Well, and as some of the other songs started almost accidentally having these references, we thought, well, let's just kind of go with that. There probably was a few other songs that I thought, okay, well, let's do another one with some kind of space theme, and then I did wrote Apollo. When's the mission to Mars? I steal a ride in the baggage car. I'll be out of my brain on the 550.
Scott actually captured the probably his best vocal ever, and I think it's on Apollo. Every time I hear that, I really listen to his voice and just go like, holy crap, this is Scott at his top of his game. That vocal just comes off sincere. It just sounds sweet. I was like, wow.
I quit smoking too. Which might have something to do.
Scott Lee Wilson, Edwin Pierce of the Something Brothers in studio. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Lovelands, is that an older song?
It is, yeah. We started playing that one toward
the very end. But
maybe like in 1990.
It's that old.
Yeah, it's a little different than it used to be.
Okay.
We kind of rethought some of the lyrics, and we rethought just the feel of the song.
Let me play just a snippet of it then here. Different now to what it was before?
Well, actually, some of the, I don't want to say effects, but the synthesizer type of thing where we didn't touch anything like that in the past.
Yeah, so Tommy was using
he's using a Mellotron pedal, and we messed around with some studio keyboard type stuff.
Yeah, Eric Nelson, who recorded the record.
Yeah, props to Eric.
Genius.
Yeah.
Anybody out there that's going to be making a record locally, talk to Eric Nelson at Eclipse Studios.
Yeah,
this guy.
He really was a key bounce off.
He had about as much to do with the final sound of this record than we did. I mean, he was constantly coming up with ideas. How about if we add this? How about if we do this? How about you change that melody a little bit?
So he had fun working with him.
He had some keyboards to that song and changed the lyrics from being a positive love song to a negative love song.
Well, that's it. It's very bittersweet.
Yeah, it's
beautiful and heartbreaking.
The guy landing in someone's arms, and then the new version, she lets him fall to the rock.
Why'd you do it that way?
I'm just a bitter old man.
Oh, this is great. Something Brothers fans, so geeked about this, and I'm one of them. Great album. Thanks for doing this.
John,
thanks for doing the album.
Thanks for coming in. If you're listening in your car, thanks for the ride. So we'll be right back.
Pierce and Scott Wilson of Bloomington's The Something Brothers, speaking with GLT's John Norton. The Something Brothers play the GLT Summer Concert, presented by SEFQ, on Saturday, June 8th in downtown Bloomington. Also appearing is Bloomington's Third Street Down, Grammy Award-winning Rebirth Brass Band, and headliner, Adia Victoria. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from John Norton and our friends at IPR. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page. We're at WGLTFM. We're also on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News, and I'm at Ryan WGLT. Let's hear a bit more of the Something Brothers. This situation's keeping us up at night. We're not gods, but we see you. Shine your light now, we need you. It's like it's all ass on backwards. I swear that I would go if you'd stay earthbound. We're not gods, but we see you. Shine your light now. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Bloomington Normal's public media.